This is your Sound Off Extra review for day one of New Japan Pro Wrestling's biggest show of the year, Wrestle Kingdom 14 at the Tokyo Dome for January 4th, 2020. I am the Solemn Monster. Night one, it was a night that saw four titles change hands. I thought it was a very good show overall, highlighted by an outstanding main event with Okada and Ibushi for the IWGP title, and a tremendous match with Will Ospreay and Hiromu Takahashi, who looks like he has not missed a beat after being out almost a year and a half after a broken, as Kurt Angle would say, a broken freaking neck. Hiromu is back. I thought a lot of the undercard dragged the show down for me in terms of, this not being a blowaway show from top to bottom. The undercard, it was fine, but a lot of the early matches just sort of existed to set either just for the sake of being there or set things up for tomorrow, not necessarily to stand on their own as anything memorable, which is what happens when you have a two-day Wrestle Kingdom instead of just one. I also was not a big fan of the Intercontinental title match with Naito and Jay White. I thought it was a good match. I didn't think it was anything great. Now, again, this is just night one, but as compared to some of the more recent Wrestle Kingdom shows, I think this one ranks a little below them. But those two matches I mentioned, the IWGP title match and the Junior Heavyweight title match, were just fantastic five-star affairs. For all you aspiring astronomers who live and die by the stars in the sky, that would be the way that I would describe it. Paid attendance was announced as 40,000, 40,008 to be exact. At the end of the show, Okada thanked everybody for selling out everything except for the seats in the outfield that they opened up the day of the show. I think this would be the largest Tokyo Dome attendance for a Wrestle Kingdom in nearly a decade. So that's a good sign. The dark match was the Stardom Women's match. This was a big deal to a lot of people when it was announced, a match that some people thought maybe never would have ever happened. It did not air. It was a dark match. Mayu Iwatani and Arisa Hoshiki defeated Hana Kimura and Julia. When Julia accidentally hit her partner with a missile drop kick, Mayu pinned Hana. Said to have been received well by the audience, but this, again, did not air. And it probably has more to do with TV contracts and such. I don't think there's any kind of underhanded thing going on here. They had their reasons why this could not air on TV. I followed the English commentary for the show, which had Kevin Kelly, Rocky Romero, Chris Charlton, and wrestler Gino Gambino, who I swear when I heard his voice for a good part of the first half of the show, I thought I was listening to Michael Schiavello, who I think some of you may know, and he's done some limited commentary in the past for New Japan. I thought I was listening to Michael Schiavello until one of the announcers said the name Gino, and then I realized that I was listening to a totally different human being. So I guess that's me being an idiot. Pre-show matches were nothing special. You had Alex Coughlin, Clark Connors, Carl Fredericks, and Toa Henare beating Yuya Uemura, Yota Tsuji, Tomoyaki Honma, and Togi Makabe. Had some veterans mixed in there with the Young Lions. Henare scored the win with his rock-bottom finish. He's got a good look. I think this guy's got a good look. I mean, compared to some of the other Young Lions they've got there, I think this guy's got potential. We had Yuji Nagata in the other pre-show match, tagging with Manabu Nakanishi against Hiroshi Tenzan and Satoshi Kojima. Yuji Nagata, still out there doing his thing after all these years. All these guys, really. I mean, the youngest guy in the match was Tenzan. I looked up his age. He's 48 years old. So these are the veteran crew here. This was their greatest hits for about 5 minutes. Kojima pinned Nakanishi with a lariat. I thought this was short and inoffensive. Main card opened with Jushin Thunder Liger in the penultimate match of his career, tagging with Tatsumi Fujinami, the great Sasuke in Tiger Mask 4, taking on Naoki Sano, Shinjiro Otani, Tatsuhito Takayawa, and Risuke Taguchi, over 3,500 matches for Liger in his career. All the legends got their own entrances. They were able to round up a lot of Liger's old rivals over the years for this, and Yeah, considering the age of a lot of them, I thought this was better than I expected it to be. You know, Sano is 54 years old. He did a suicide dive out to the floor, landed right on his knees. He and Liger had some classic battles against one another, all the way back, we were told, in 1989. Sasuke missed a swanton bomb at one point. Later on, he took a superplex off the top rope by Sano. Taguchi hit his chicken wing facebuster on Liger and pinned him to win the match. And Kevin Kelly could not hide his disappointment on commentary. I was in the same boat. I was not expecting Taguchi to pin Liger. I wasn't expecting Liger to lose. I mean, I figured he was losing on day two. And, you know, he give him one last win on day one. Crowd didn't seem to like it either. But, yeah, I guess Liger doing the honors both nights on the way out. Old school to the very end. I would be just as shocked to see him win on day two as I was to see him lose here on day one. Shingo Takagi, Bushi, Evil, and Sonata against Suzuki Goons, El Desperado, Tai Chi, Zack Sabre Jr., and Minoru Suzuki. You know, for a guy who had what I thought was the match of the year in 2019 with Will Ospreay at the finals of the Best of the Super Juniors, it's too bad that Shingo had a nothing match here on this show. He was just background noise. You know, nothing significant for him here on the show at all. Now, Sonata and Sabre are wrestling on day two in a few hours here for the Rev Pro British Heavyweight title. They had some interaction here in this match. The story is that Sonata cannot put his paradise lock on Sabre, who he's a submission specialist, and he's got all kinds of counters and all kinds of submissions himself. You can't put him in the paradise lock. He did get the move on El Desperado here. Sabre in the end submitted Bushi with a Rings of Saturn-like submission to win it for Suzuki Goon. Yeah, I keep seeing the rumor that Minoru Suzuki is finishing up with New Japan. And they may possibly shoot some kind of an angle around it on the New Year's Dash show on Monday. You know, maybe to boot him out of the group the way they did with AJ Styles a few years ago when he got booted from Bullet Club. I hope that's not true. I mean, look, if he's leaving, then yeah, you shoot an angle. But I hope Suzuki's not leaving. We can't lose Suzuki. I mean, come on. So hopefully that's not true. We have Yoshihashi, Toriano, Tomohiro Ishii, and Hiroki Goto against Kenta, Chase Owens, Yujiro Takahashi, and Bad Luck Fale representing Bullet Club. The real story here is the girl who accompanies Yujiro to the ring. The only thing I find even remotely interesting about Yujiro. Need to see more of her. Yano made a big spectacle at the beginning of this match, as he does in most of his matches, making a spectacle, about wanting to start the match out, until he realized that Bad Luck Fale was opposing him on the other side of the ring. Then he didn't seem so enthusiastic about it anymore. So he tried a couple of shoulder tackles, and Fale didn't budge, and finally Fale takes him down with a tackle of his own, and Yano bolted into the corner and undid the corner turnbuckle pad. Yano is great. Yano is great. Reminds me of the match he had with Moxley. What was it? The G1. Over the summer. Very entertaining. So there was another spot in this match that stood out to me. Because it was one of the only other ones I marked down. So clearly if I wrote it down, it must have meant something to me. Was Ishii. Ishii's another one. He's awesome. He's fantastic. It's too bad he didn't have a more high-profile match here on the show. But he executed a standing suplex on Bad Luck Fale. Now, they bill Fale at, what, 360, probably? And I'm sure that's an exaggeration, but it can't be by that much. Fale is a big dude. And maybe, you know what, maybe he is 360. I'm just assuming, hey, it's wrestling. Even in Japan, I'm sure these things tend to be exaggerated just a little bit. But he's a big dude. And Ishii got him up in the air, held him there for a couple seconds, and then dropped him. It was a sight to behold. It was awesome. Goto pinned Yujiro after his GTR finish and stared a hole through Kenta, who he challenges on day two for the Never Openweight title. These matches felt like something you would see on the go-home episode to a pay-per-view here in this country, not the pay-per-view itself. I think that's my biggest problem with some of these matches. But that's the two-day format. You know, it'd be interesting to see if they do it again next year. given that this was the first time. So a lot of this stuff just kind of felt like filler. It just felt like, yeah, a little preview of what's to come tomorrow. But anyway, so this was fine. This had its moments, like the Ishii suplex and pretty much anything Yano does. So I enjoyed it. We had the Gorillas of Destiny, G.O.D., Tama Tonga, Tangaloa, defending their IWGP Tag Team titles. Their fifth reign, I believe it is, defending against the winners of the World Tag League, Finjuice, David Finlay, and Kevin Owens' favorite wrestler, Juice Robinson. So Finlay and Juice, they hit the ring first, and G.O.D.'s coming out. And they decide to go on out after them and meet them on the ramp. So a brawl breaks out, and I lost track of what happened to David Finlay. And I went back, and I believe he got tossed or tumbled, whatever happened, off the side of the ramp. So he was gone for a while. But Juice Robinson took a back body drop on the ramp, and he bounced. His body bounced. Well, whatever the ramp is made of, wood, I guess. Could be steel, probably wood. Either way, I'm sure that did not feel too good. Fast forward a little bit, G.O.D. hits a magic killer on Finlay. Juice breaks it up, saves the match. Juice ends up beating a magic killer himself. And Finlay turned a super powerbomb attempt by G.O.D. into a top rope Rana. Jado on the outside stuck his nose in the match, hit Finlay in the head with a kendo stick at one point without the referee seeing. That got a near fall. For the finish, Juice hit the left hand of God on Tama Tonga. Finlay hit the sliced bread on Tonga for the pin. And we have new tag team champions, Juice Robinson and David Finlay. I thought it was a good match and a great comeback story. You know, in his very first Tokyo Dome match, getting the pin for David Finlay. He missed about 6 months. He had surgery for a torn labrum, which for some reason my notes here auto-corrected to labia. I just noticed. A torn labia sounds far more painful. But the Gorillas of Destiny, you know, as tough as they come across, they are winless. They are now winless in four appearances here at Wrestle Kingdom. Jon Moxley against Lance Archer for Archer's IWGP United States Championship in a Texas death match, which you win by knockout or submission only. So no pinfalls, no countouts, none of that BS. And as Moxley ponders Chris Jericho's offer to join the Inner Circle in AEW and get himself a new 4GT, here he was out to reclaim the title that he never lost. It was taken from him after travel issues a few months ago. He was never pinned. He was never defeated. He threw a bunch of chairs into the ring at the start, before Archer even got into the ring. There was one moment early on where Archer, he does the top rope walk like The Undertaker does in a lot of his matches. Very impressive. He's a big dude. He's every bit of 6'9", right? They bill him at 6'9". And to see a guy that big, you know, on the top rope walking along is always an impressive thing. Well, he lost his footing. Now, I'm not sure if that was intended or not. It's possible that he just slipped. You know, shit happens. But Moxley immediately grabbed a kendo stick and began whacking him with it a bunch of times. So if it was a botch, Moxley thought fast on his feet and covered for it well. So Moxley tried for a dive. Archer caught him, chokeslammed him on the apron. And he grabbed one of the young lions at ringside. And, you know, he was just beating the hell out of anybody who was in his way. And then at one point he hit the Roman Reigns Superman dive out onto Moxley and wiped out him and a whole bunch of young lions. So Archer sets up four chairs inside the ring. He hits his blackout move on Moxley onto the chairs. Moxley struggles up to his feet by the count of eight. Archer uses his EBD claw. Everybody dies. Locks the claw on. Moxley slips out into an armbar. Later on, Archer reaches down into his pants, and this is getting dirty now, and pulls out a plastic bag, puts the bag over Moxley's face, applies the EBD claw over the bag, trying to smother this man to death. And that will not be allowed here in New York anymore, starting in March, when our new plastic bag ban goes into effect. Moxley hit a Death Rider off the apron through two tables outside that I believe Archer, if I remember, set up. And so he puts him, and Moxley went through one of the tables himself. And so Archer goes through one, and Moxley goes through one. The Archer went through head first, and he was not getting up from that. He could not beat the count. Moxley wins the match. He wins the championship. And Archer, we just, for a few seconds, got a shot after the match. His arm was all cut up. I couldn't tell where the injury was sustained, but he had some kind of an injury. Archer did some kind of a wound. He got sliced open maybe on his hand or his arm. I thought this was very good. I mean, this was exactly what you would expect a Texas death match to look like. You know, it was just all action. Never a slow moment here. You had the usual weapons. You had the usual violence you would hope for. And I thought they might give Archer the win here. You know, that Moxley would be bounced on night one, and we would get Juice and Archer in a rematch on night two. Instead, it'll be a rematch between Moxley and Juice Robinson. And their first match many months ago, when Moxley first came to New Japan and won the championship, was actually an excellent match. So I have pretty high expectations for this match on day two. Hiromu Takahashi, speaking of high expectations, against Will Ospreay for the IWGP Junior Heavyweight title. Will Ospreay is the man who I named on the podcast last week as my wrestler of the year for 2019. There were a lot of good choices. He's the one I went with. I thought he had a breakout year for his career. Incredible matches. Matured as a performer. And so there were some high expectations coming into this match, because these two, this is not the first dance they've had together inside the ring. They've met before. In fact, the last time, I guess, would have been when Takahashi beat Ospreay for the championship. And then a month later is when he broke his neck. So this was one of the feature matches here coming into this event. Hiromu rolls outside. This is a few minutes into the match. And Ospreay goes for a Sasuke special. Just, I can't even describe in words from start to finish accurately with any great detail better than just watching it for yourself, what this guy was able to pull off. From the first attempt at this Sasuke special, he lands on the outside, and Hiromu catches him. He tries to give him a German suplex, and Ospreay again lands on his feet. He backs up down the ramp a little bit. He comes charging in at Hiromu. Hiromu basically gives him a flip, or like a belly-to-belly suplex, but he basically throws Ospreay back into the ring, and he immediately hits the ropes and goes for another Sasuke special, and this time he hits it, and he lands on the floor. Now, somewhere in here, it sounds like Ospreay may have been hurt. He may have suffered an ankle injury. I saw PW Insider said there's a fear that it could be a broken heel. But there's been no other information, as I am sitting here right now, released on what happened or if, in fact, he is injured. So it wouldn't shock me if he was, just the way he landed. When you're doing stuff like this, you can roll an ankle, you can break an ankle. He'll be lucky if he didn't, rupture an Achilles. Clearly that didn't happen, or else I don't think he would have been able to finish the match the way he did. So it could be a lot worse, but hopefully if he is hurt, it's not too bad. This whole sequence here from start to finish was just amazing. Amazing to watch. So Ospreay targeted the neck, as you would expect. I mean, this guy just came back from a broken neck. So what logic would there be in not going after the neck here in this match? There was at least one, I got to call him out on this. As great as Will Ospreay is, he is not infallible. There was at least one Ospreay drop kick in here. There might have been more than one, but I'm thinking of this one in particular. And if you saw the match, you probably know what I'm talking about. He went for a missile drop kick off the top rope that was supposed to connect with the back of Hiromu's head, and it did not. But Hiromu sold it like it did. I guess you could say, well, couldn't he feel whether or not the kick connected or not? Maybe yes, maybe no. As a wrestler, I'm sure your first instinct is just sell the move. So he sold the move, and he collapsed like he got shot. But clearly, Ospreay whiffed on the drop kick, and it looked terrible. Now, look, the man just came back from a broken neck, so he should be thankful that it missed, and probably shouldn't be taking a drop kick to the back of the head. But he did, and it looked silly. Hiromu hit a DVD later on into the corner turnbuckles, or the turnbuckle pad. I'm still thinking of Yano from earlier in the pad that he removed. Ospreay blocked a time bomb. Hiromu hit two thrust kicks. Again tries for the time bomb. hook kick by Will Ospreay. Goes for a Stormbreaker. Hiromu gets out, hits the ropes, and runs right into a standing Spanish fly for a near fall. There was a hidden blade, which I always cringe when Ospreay, because I think back to the match he had with Ibushi, which I think was the first time that he debuted that move. And if I remember correctly, he legitimately knocked Ibushi silly, which is not hard to understand if you watch this move. I mean, he just destroys people with this elbow to the back of the head. He killed Hiromu with a hidden blade. And Ospreay went for a Stormbreaker. Hiromu turned it into a destroyer for a near fall. So as brutal as the hidden blade looked like, he didn't sell it for very long. That kind of bothered me. But again, I understand that he's back. And it's not as though you can just say, hey, you know, okay, I'm not going to take this kind of move and I'm not going to take that kind of move. He wrestles a certain style. And even in New Japan in general, there's a certain style. And so if you're back, then you're back. You're all in. You know, he's got the all clear from his doctors. Everything's cool. But I do question the, how wise it is for him to take a move like that coming off a broken neck, but it is what it is. These guys are going to go out there and they're going to do their thing. You know, there's not much else you can really do. So he didn't sell it for very long. Hiromu hit a lariat, hit the time bomb. Ospreay kicked out. Hiromu goes for a running forearm, hits the forearm, gets a cradle driver. He dropped Ospreay right on his head. And Hiromu covers him and gets the pin. Now, this was this new move, I guess, that he had been teasing, that he was going to unveil some kind of new move here in this match. And that was the move. You know, it's kind of like a cradle driver of sorts. And dropped Ospreay, again, on the back of his head and got the pin. Despite the little hiccup I mentioned on the dropkick thing before, this was an absolutely fantastic match. Hiromu was in top form. Ospreay was in top form. And if he was hurt, you would never know. You know, if he hurt his ankle, he wasn't limping. He wasn't hobbling. It didn't affect him in the ring at all. These guys went out there, and I think they blew away expectations. This was an absolute clinic between these two. It was a great war back and forth. And easily the second best thing, I thought the second best thing outside of the main event on the entire show. So I can't say enough good things about this match. And that brought us to the Intercontinental Championship match. Jay White defending his IWGP Intercontinental title against the former champion Tetsuya Naito, with the winner going on to meet the winner of the main event on day two to crown a new double champion. Now, I understand that nobody was going to be able to follow Ospreay and Hiromu and not feel slower or slow paced by comparison, but this match I thought just dragged on far too long. You know, now the final few minutes it picked up a bit, but this was my least favorite of the final three matches on this show, which I thought all ranged from good, which this one was, to outstanding, which the other two were. This was the good match of the three. Ghetto was out there doing his thing. He was interfering and sticking his nose where it didn't belong. He grabbed Naito's ankle early on the apron twice. And Jay White was able to get Naito down, and he was crotched on the post. Referee's attention was diverted by Jay White. Ghetto took a chair outside and slammed the chair into Naito's left knee against the post. And so began a match-long story of Naito's bad knee. And really, his bad knees. Because his, the wraps and everything that you see on Naito's knees, from what I understand, that's not a gimmick. It's not for show. You know, he's beat up physically, which also makes me question the logic of not putting the championship on him a couple of years ago at Wrestle Kingdom, when he seemed to be as hot as he had ever been. And now he's 2 years older. He's more beat up. I mean, he's still a popular guy. I don't doubt that he's still one of the most popular stars they have in New Japan, but definitely feels like he's cooled off a lot since, 2018. I guess it was 2018. I guess it would have been 2018 when they did not pull the trigger with him and Okada. But anyway, This just dragged. It just felt like it dragged. I understand they were telling the injury story and Naito fighting his way back and all that, but it just wasn't exciting. It wasn't interesting to me as much as I think it might have been for some people listening. For me, it just didn't click the way that it should have. White hit a dragon screw over the middle rope about 20 minutes in. He tried to shoot Naito off the ropes. Naito just collapsed in a heap, selling the knee. There was another spot. Jay White suplexed Naito out over the ropes. He landed headfirst on the apron, just crash landed on the apron. Not as brutal as what we saw the suplex that Ibushi took in his match with Naito last year. That was on a different level. How that guy's neck is not like jelly, I'll never know. But this still looked pretty nasty. Jay White, inverted dragon screw, goes for an inverted figure four. Long submission tease here. Naito finally is able to crawl over and make it to the bottom rope. And Jay White tried for a second time. Naito spit in his face. Fast forward a little bit. Naito goes for the Destino. White shoves off. And he shoves Naito right into red shoes. And down goes the referee. That's Ghetto's time. It's his sign. Get up into the ring. He jumps into the ring with a chair. Naito avoids the chair. Jay White, though, catches him with a low blow. And White goes for Blade Runner. Referee is revived. Red Shoes is back up. Naito blocks it. White hits another sleeper suplex. Naito pops right back up. Hits the Destino. Poison Rana. Destino again for a near fall. Naito tries for another Destino. White blocks it. He goes for Blade Runner. Naito hits yet another Destino. And this time gets the pin to win back the championship. Red Shoes pulled up a little bit on that three count. I don't know if he saw Jay White's shoulder. He had a better view maybe if his shoulder was up slightly and was trying to call it like a shoot and didn't want to count the three. I don't know what was going on there. I'm trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. Red Shoes has quite a few years of experience doing this. So it was kind of weird. It was very awkward. It made for a very awkward finish. But Naito wins. He does it. He pulls it off. He wins back the Intercontinental title. And he moves on in the double gold dash on night two tomorrow, which brings us to the main event. The IWGP Championship, Okada, Ibushi. Of course, Kota Ibushi is the G1 Climax winner. You got to see the Okada Rainmaker entrance here on this show. This was awesome. This was awesome. Now, I know there was a Wrestle Kingdom many years ago with a dinosaur and a giant sword. He's had some unique entrances. But this one may be, I think, his best. And he was also wearing glow-in-the-dark gear on his way to the ring. So as they had this faraway shot of the ramp and you see Okada walking to the ring, you can't even see Okada himself. You see his jacket. It's kind of weird. You can't see the belt. You can't see him. You can't see his flesh. You just see this figure approaching the ring in this long coat. And it's glowing in the dark. It's very unique. Very unique entrance here for Okada. Since Okada returned from excursion in 2012, and of course we know where he spent part of his time now, don't we? Because some people have not been able to let their animosity about it go. TNA certainly has found that out the hard way, or Impact, or whatever the fuck. But I still call them TNA. Old habits die hard, what can I say? When Okada was there, it was TNA. That's why I call it TNA. And they did not do much with him. Now, of course, he wasn't as polished. He was not as mature and as developed as a performer as he is now, back then. But still, New Japan has never been able to quite accept the way that they treated him back when he spent time in Impact all those many years ago. But since he returned from excursion in 2012, there have been 58 IWGP title matches. Okada has been in 42 of them. Kevin Kelly actually shouted out Cordell Mitchell for that statistic. Our very own Cordell Mitchell. So shout out to Cordell in the Facebook group. He is, anybody who knows him, he is Mr. New Japan. He is all things New Japan, big fan. And so it was very cool to hear him get shouted out on the show here at the beginning of this main event championship match on day one. That was awesome. Ibushi went for a Pele kick in the match at one point and landed right on top of his head. It would be like AJ Styles going for the Pele kick, but just dying right in the middle of the move, like out of a cartoon, and just falling straight down on his head. I gasped. I was like, oh shit. Thankfully, he was okay, but he landed right on top of his head and neck. Okada grabbed hold of him immediately, tried to turn it into a tombstone, but which would have been even worse. But Ibushi countered it into a bastard driver. He spiked Okada down right on his head, so tit for tat. That was embarrassing. You know, I'm sure he didn't feel too happy about that, that botched backflip kick. You hate to see it. But again, he's lucky he didn't break his neck. Ibushi gave Okada a standing double foot stomp right after this. As Okada ran towards him, he gave him this standing double stomp that just stomped the soul out of Okada. And Cameron Grimes uses that move. I just got done talking about this, in fact, a few weeks ago in the podcast. Cameron Grimes uses that same move, the standing double stomp, as his finish in NXT. And I don't think it ever looks all that good. I don't think it ever looks really devastating enough for him to use it as a finish. This looked pretty damn devastating. I don't know if it's because Ibushi's a little bit bigger than Cameron Grimes, or at least he comes across to me that way on TV as being a little bit bigger. I don't know if it's just I think it's just the way he hit this with such ferocity. It looked devastating enough. And he followed that with a moonsault off the top rope out to the floor, crash landed right on top of Okada. At the 25-minute mark, I have to say, outside of the finish, this was my favorite part of the match. Okada was smacking Ibushi. And as he's smacking him around, the emotion just completely drained from Ibushi's face. Like the blows were not even phasing him at all. And then things got scary. He got Okada down, and he started firing away with closed fists. I mean, these were shots that were reverberating throughout the Tokyo Dome. Okada's trying to cover up, like, his life is in jeopardy. It's like an MMA fight. Red Shoes, he was admonishing Ibushi for using the closed fist. You can't do that. He tried to pull him away from Okada. He wouldn't budge. Ibushi turned into a scary SOB here during this part of the match. Fans started booing him a little bit. He was a scary dude. He's a scary-ass dude here during this part of the match. Something ticked him off, and he just teed off on Okada. And there was nothing Okada could do about it. He was just cowering, trying to protect himself and shield himself. That's all he could do. So then Ibushi teased a deadlift German from the apron to the ring. Okada blocked it. So now they're both out on the apron. Okada tries for the tombstone. Ibushi reverses it. Okada gets him back up for the tombstone, finally drops him down on his head. Head first on the apron. Ibushi barely climbs back into the ring before the 20 count. It was 19 and a half, and he gets back into the ring. And Okada immediately drops him with an air raid crash across the knee for a near fall. Okada hits a German. He's grabbing Ibushi's wrist. On the landing, Okada goes for a rainmaker. Ibushi counters with a lariat. Okada rolls out to the apron. Ibushi hits a deadlift German from the second rope and propels Okada backwards into the ring for a near fall. He folded Okada up pretty damn good on that move. And at this point, we were at about the half-hour mark in this match. Ibushi goes for a lawn dart. Okada slips out, hits a spinning tombstone. Goes for a rainmaker. Ibushi reverses into a rainmaker of his own. Both guys are down. Ibushi connects with the Bomae, tribute to Shinsuke Nakamura. Okada kicks out at one. Definitely not a tribute to Shinsuke Nakamura. Ibushi hits another one for a two count. And finally, he hits the Kamigoye. Okada kicks out right at the last second. Ibushi goes up for a Phoenix Splash. He crashes and burns. Okada hit two Rainmakers, and I thought, well, that's it. I thought that was going to be the end of the match. Ibushi, though, kicked out. And Okada hit two more Rainmakers with a third one coming. Ibushi, though, ducked, went for the Kamigoye. Okada blocked that, hit a sit-out tombstone, and one final Rainmaker to put it away. Okada retains and defends against Naito on day two. Naito did come out with his new championship when the match was over. They had a little face-to-face in the ring. When this match was over, when the bell rang and Okada's in there celebrating and his music is playing, and you're kind of coming down from the high of those last few minutes, I really wish that Ibushi had won. You know, I had predicted that Naito was my pick to win everything at the start. And when I did the predictions last week, I said, you know, my prediction was, which I don't think was much of a stretch, I think conventional wisdom had an Okada final against Naito. And then you would have Jay White against Kota Ibushi on day two in the meeting of, basically the meeting of the losers from day one. So that was my prediction. So I, in my head, I was looking for that, I was expecting it. But when the match was over, I just felt like Ibushi should have gone over. It just felt like the right time, right? And I think he would have, were it not for this double gold dash story that they have going. And the story arc with Naito, which needs to be completed tomorrow. It has to be Naito. But were it not for the two belt stuff, if this was a traditional one-night Wrestle Kingdom, I think Ibushi would have won and should have won. You know, but Okada has to be the man that Naito beats to complete his arc. So I get it. I understand it. But I just felt, oh man, this, you hope that they didn't kind of wait one too long, like it feels like they did with Naito a couple years ago, that they didn't just do that with Ibushi. I mean, I think he'll be fine. I think he'll win the championship. And in fact, in 2020, we'll probably see Ibushi holding the IWGP title. You know, I mean, I said that about Jay White a year ago. And then Jay White, I think a month later, won the championship. I wasn't expecting him to win it that quickly. I wasn't expecting him to lose it that quickly either. But it just feels like the right time. And so I can't say enough good things about this main event. It was, you know, in a lot of ways a typical Okada main event where it starts slow. They take their time. This is a pattern. This is a formula to a lot of the Okada matches that I've seen, and a lot of the Okada, just the way he does these matches, that's why these matches end up being 35, 40, 50 minutes. I mean, you can't go balls to the wall at the very beginning. It builds slowly, takes its time, and then it kind of reaches this crescendo, and then you have that frenetic finish where people just lose their minds, you know, and he's had all these classic matches. So it's hard to argue against the formula, but this was just tremendous stuff. But again, I think my favorite part of the whole thing was about 25 minutes or so in when Ibushi just became, it was almost like he was having some kind of outer body experience where he wasn't all there. I love this match. I thought it was great. Night one is in the books. We turn to night two. This is your Sound Off Extra review for day two of Wrestle Kingdom 14. At the Tokyo Dome, it is January 6, 2020. I am an exhausted Solomonster. I will have thoughts on the New Year Dash show from earlier this morning as well. I'll save that for the end. Overall, Wrestle Kingdom Night 2 was an excellent show with a main event. I thought that was on par with the first one that we got the night before and with less filler. So I might rank it slightly above Night 1. But really, they were pretty comparable. Night 1 had some matches that just existed to get you excited, you know, for what was coming in Night 2. I did like the Moxley match more on Night 1 with Lance Archer than I did his match here with Juice Robinson. But Tanahashi and Jericho was very good. It's a tough call. You know, I enjoyed them both, but if I had to give the edge to one over the other, I might give the edge to this show. Four title changes on Night 2 to join the four title changes on Night 1. So, eight title changes this weekend. That's a lot of titles changing hands. The attendance for Night 2 was just a shade over 30,000. So, 10,000 less than Night 1. But combined, the two nights of Wrestle Kingdom combined for over 70,000, which sounds pretty good. It's actually, I think, above, just in general, the last few years have been above what Wrestle Kingdom had done in years past. The announcers again were Kevin Kelly, Chris Charlton, and Gino Gambino. Rocky Romero joined them later on. He had some obligations. He was going to be at ringside for the Roppongi 3K tag match, so he chimed in a little bit later. Pre-show had the gauntlet for the never openweight six-man tag team titles. Risuke Taguchi, Togi Makabe, and Toriano defending against Robbie Eagles, Yoshihashi and Tomohiro Ishii, Bushi, Shingo Takagi, and Evil, the team of Kanemaru, El Desperado, and Tai Chi, and Chase Owens, Yujiro Takahashi, and Bad Luck Fale representing Bullet Club. Match open with Bullet Club against Chaos. First big spot of the match. Fale drops Eagles with a chokeslam clothesline combo, goes for the pin, and Robbie Eagles forgets to get his shoulder up. So the referee has to hold up the count. And the announcers, who were, you know, chattering away, they just go silent. They didn't even try to explain that one away. And so we're off to the races. Ishii eliminates Chase Owens with the brainbuster. So Bullet Club is gone. That brings out Suzuki-Gun, Tai Chi, Kanemaru, and El Desperado. Robbie Eagles pinned Kanemaru. Bushi, Shingo, and Evil out next. Bushi was out there wearing a Venom mask. That was pretty cool. Always fun to see Evil and Ishii in there beating the holy hell out of each other. Evil dropped him with Darkness Falls. Referee counted three, but Ishii kicked out at the last second. Looks like the referee maybe wasn't supposed to count the three. So that kind of made for an awkward moment. Ishii went right back after Evil. Evil dropped him with Everything is Evil, which makes me, again, that makes me think that might have been the planned finish. I don't know if I could pin that one on the referee. Referee seemed pretty shaky here, but I don't know if I can pin that one on him. But not a good start to the festivities tonight when it came to the officiating, at least with the falls here. This referee looked new. He looked American. I think he's somebody out of their LA dojo. Jeremy or Jerome, I think Gino identified him at one point. I don't want to pick on him too much. He seemed very nervous, though. Even after the match, he didn't know, like, pick up the titles, hand them to the champions. I saw Evil had to mouth to him. He had to tell him to stand between them and raise their hands for the audience when it was over. But before then, the champions were out next. Togi Makabe, Risuke Taguchi, and Toriano. They've been the six-man champions for nearly one full year. Finish came when Taguchi had Shingo in an ankle lock. Shingo grabbed the referee. He was just wailing around out of desperation, grabs the ref, and shoves him aside. And then he rolled out of the ankle lock, which sent Taguchi falling forward into the mist to the face by Bushi. Referee didn't see it. Shingo with a lariat finishes Taguchi off with his Made in Japan pump handle half Nelson driver that he uses to win the titles for LIJ. And so they are your new six-man champions. The main card opened with the retirement match. This is it. This is what it's been building to for all these months. The final match in the career of Jushin Thunder Liger, tagging with his old rival Naoki Sano against Hiromu Takahashi and his rival. I mean, I guess you can call him his rival. He's the man who broke his neck back in 2018. The former Dragon Lee, now going by Ryu Lee, making his New Japan debut. Liger ate the pin on night one. So the night before this, his first of two retirement matches, Liger not only lost, but he ate the pin. So it seemed pretty obvious going into this that he was going to go back, right back on his back on the way out. Because I couldn't imagine him winning in the last match, right? I mean, he lost on night one, a match that I thought he should have won, since it seemed pretty obvious he was losing on night two. And then I realized, oh, he's going to lose both nights. That's awful. He has his reasons for it, but he should have at least won one of these matches. So they had Yoshiaki Fujiwara, the innovator of the Fujiwara armbar. He was there. He was one of the men who helped train Liger. He got a whole entrance and everything. He shook hands with Liger. He stayed ringside for the match, almost like a coach. Liger starts out with Hiromu, tortures him. He's using a bow and arrow. He's got the Romero special. Hiromu tags in Ryu Lee. And Liger sees this, he goes, okay, I'll tag my partner in too. And he turns and he goes to tag in Sano. And Lee and Hiromu run over, they knock Sano off the apron, they start double-teaming Liger. Boos from the crowd, easy heat here. I mean, beating up Jushin Liger in his final match, I mean, come on. So Hiromu is in control, and Liger ends up, is able to hit a powerbomb. And Liger is just slapping the shit out of Hiromu. Ryu Lee makes a save. Hits a tope, or goes for a tope, accidentally hits his partner. So he accidentally hits Hiromu on the tope. And he's in, he hits a knee strike, super kick from Hiromu. The two of them hit a double knee strike on Liger for a near fall. Liger counters Hiromu's time bomb into a cradle for a near fall. Lariat by Hiromu, and the time bomb is all she wrote. Match went a little under, I would say about 13 minutes or so. And just like that, the career of Jushin Thunder Liger has come to an end. Now, around this point, as soon as the match ended, my feed froze. And I don't know what happened. I don't know if he said anything on the microphone. I believe he did. Not that I would have been able to understand him. But when the feed resumed, Liger was already in the aisle walking down, slapping hands with the fans. So this is what he wanted it to be. And look, he got his wish. You know, he probably got to handpick the people he wanted to tag with, the people he wanted to work with. I know he said the New Year Dash show this morning, it meant a lot to him that it was Hiromu. He fell to his hand in his final match. Obviously, he must think the world of him. So I know a lot of the fans would have liked to have seen him get a win at some point this weekend, but this is what he wanted, you know. This is how he envisioned his retirement, and he got what he wanted. El Fantasmo and Taiji Ishimori representing Bullet Club, defending the IWGP Junior Tag Team titles against Roppongi 3K, Yo, and Sho, who earned the shot after winning their third straight Super Junior Tag League. I thought this was really good. Fantasmo gave... This was my favorite part. As good as the match was, this, of all things, was my favorite part. Fantasmo gives Sho a dick punch. But he sells it like he hurt his hand, almost like he broke his hand. And Sho reaches down and he reveals that he was wearing a cup. He pulls a cup out from, and I don't mean a solo cup, I mean an athletic supporter here. He pulls a cup out from his pants. And I'm thinking, if only Brock Lesnar, and if only AJ Styles watched more New Japan, then perhaps they could have avoided that same fate in all the times that they suffered various blows and boots to the crotch area. For years I said this, AJ, when he was wrestling Nakamura, what the hell's wrong with this guy? Just wear a cup. He didn't listen. Somebody put together this hilarious compilation of all the times. It was like a 2-minute YouTube video. Some compilation of all the times in that feud with Nakamura that AJ got either kicked in the dick or low-blowed in some way. It was hilarious. It was his own fault. Roppongi won the titles with the Lucha Bros finish of the double stomp by Yo off the top into the package pile driver. I guess they call it the shock arrow on Fantasmo for the win. And so they are once again the Junior Heavyweight Tag Team Champions. Zack Sabre Jr. defends his British Heavyweight title against Sonata. I thought this was a lot of fun. Just, you know, tit for tat. Lots of counters, reversals. That was the story of the match. It was going to come down to who made a mistake, and in this case, it was Sonata. Sonata hit a drop kick to the right leg. Sabre selling the right leg. He tries for a penalty kick. Sonata catches it. He wrenches again on the leg. And Sonata tried for a dragon screw. Sabre blocked it. He went for a driver. Sonata blocked that. Again, back and forth we went here. So they're trading uppercuts. And Sonata misses a springboard. They go for a series of near falls. They're cradling and rolling each other up back and forth. Sonata hits a moonsault. Yeah, he does the moonsault off the top right into Skull End. And Zack Sabre is able to escape into a European clutch for a near fall. So for the finish here, Sonata grabs Skull End, and Sabre is able to reverse out of it. Sonata pulls away. He tries again for the Skull End. Boy, he loves that Skull End, doesn't he? They trade various pin attempts. Sabre ends up on top in the European clutch for the pin. So, you know, you can call it a fluky finish if you want to. Again, the story was somebody was going to make a mistake. Very evenly matched, and in this case, it was Sonata. I had Sonata picked to win, so I was kind of surprised by that. And, of course, Sonata also was the only member of the LIJ faction to escape this weekend without a championship. So there's that little stat as well. Not a great weekend, I guess, for Sonata, although he did end up picking up a win at the New Year Dash. We had Jon Moxley defending the IWGP United States Championship that he won 24 hours earlier from Lance Archer against the former champion here, Juice Robinson, now one half of the IWGP Tag Team Champions with David Finlay. They call themselves Finn Juice, which I know there's a lot of Finn Balor fans or what were the stands, whatever, that you see these crazy people online who just obsess over a particular individual. And you can imagine the fun that I saw some of them having with the Finn Juice name. I won't get into that. I won't paint that picture for you. You can pretty much imagine what they were talking about. But the question here is, would Juice be able to leave the Tokyo Dome as a double champion? Now, all the chatter was about Okada and Naito. One of them will leave with two titles. Juice could have left a double champion as well. This was not as great as their first match, where Moxley won the title last summer, but it was good. I thought the match was good. Juice hit a plancha out onto Moxley. As soon as Moxley got to the ring, before he could even get inside, Juice hit a plancha out on top of him. And Moxley grabs a chair, he sets it up. Juice gets the advantage, he sits Moxley down, or Moxley sits down in the chair. And Juice hits a cannonball, knocks him over. So finally they get inside the ring. And Moxley ducks the left hand of God. He put him in a figure four. Juice got to the rope for the break. He did the figure four Moxley did around the post. The old Bret Hart figure four leg lock around the post. I love that move. So Moxley puts a chair around Juice's neck. And he teases that he's going to swing like a baseball swing with another chair. Which we actually saw Evil, I think it was Evil, do that at the New Year Dash this morning. And the chair went flying. I think the chair went flying into the crowd. Hopefully it didn't knock somebody out. But anyway, here he didn't really have a chance, Moxley, to pull it off here. Juice, he punched the chair back into Moxley's face. The left hand got into the chair, which he did once before, as the announcers pointed out, and he broke his hand. So, not a very wise move on the part of Juice Robinson. And back inside, he hits a jackhammer on Moxley for a near fall. Goes for Pulp Friction. Moxley blocks it, hits a German. Juice comes back, German of his own. And he blocks the Death Rider from Moxley, rolls Moxley out, almost had him, but not quite. So Juice comes back, he hits two of the left hands of God. And Juice goes for Pulp Friction. Moxley reverses into a Death Rider. And then an elevated second Death Rider gets the pin to retain the title. Two straight Tokyo Dome wins for John Moxley. And as Moxley gets his hand raised, all of a sudden, we hear the theme music of Minoru Suzuki. And all of a sudden, all was right with the world, if only for a few minutes. Suzuki walked out, he's wearing a tracksuit. And as he's walking to the ring, he takes the tracksuit off. He's already in his gear. He's ready for combat. He's ready to kill. Climbs inside. He squares up with John Moxley. They trade blows back and forth. And Suzuki grabs a rear naked choke. And he hits the gotch pile driver. Almost every time I see this guy go for the gotch in a match, he never hits it. But he hit it here on Moxley. And Suzuki grabbed the microphone. He cut a promo. He said to Moxley, the translation, I guess, was, who do you think you're picking a fight with? Well, he came out to pick a fight with Moxley. Moxley didn't pick a fight with him. It's like some of these people who call into my live review shows. Like, I'm taking calls. They're like, oh, thanks for calling. I'm like, I didn't call you. You called me. So Suzuki said he's the king of pro wrestling. He says if Moxley wants a fight, Suzuki will end up as the king of the United States. It's fine with me. Fine with me. I welcome our new Japanese overlord. So Moxley, finally, he's revived. He has no idea where he is. He attacks one of the young lions. He thought he was Suzuki. And I thought the match itself was fine, but the post-match angle was just fantastic. Because now it sets up the match that I and a lot of people have been waiting to see, which is John Moxley and Minoru Suzuki. Give it to me now. I want it now. I don't want to wait. I want it right now. Like wrestling fans in 2020, right? I want everything right now. I don't want to wait. We had Kenta defending the Never Openweight title. See, more waiting. I don't want to wait. The Never Openweight title against Hirooki Goto. Kenta comes out to the ring all by himself, no Bullet Club. There was a devastating basement drop kick in the corner by Kenta, which is a move that he himself innovated. As they pointed out, Shibata took the move from him. Boy, this guy's had a lot of people taking moves from him. So, but this basement dropkick just was sickening. Follow that up with a double stump right to the guts of Goto for a near fall. Hit a Busaiku knee for a near fall. He goes for the go to sleep. Goto catches Kenta's leg on the way down before the knee could hit, and he delivers a headbutt. So they trade strikes back and forth. A couple of minutes later, Goto hits the GTR and scores the pin to win the championship in a match that I really didn't think was anything overly special. You know, no Shibata appearance. That surprised me. I thought maybe he'd be in Goto's corner or something. No Shibata anywhere. And Goto's record in title matches in the Tokyo Dome now improves to 6-0. They announced the dates for some of the big shows in 2020, including the start of the G1 Climax. It is the 30th G1, and it will commence in October. So much later than usual. It's pushed back to the fall due to the Tokyo Olympics. So I guess a lot of the buildings that they normally would run for the G1 are going to be occupied by this pesky thing called the Olympics. So they had to push the G1 back. October 16th, 17th, and 18th are the initial dates announced. Jay White against Kota Ibushi, the two, well, they call them runners-up. We'll call them what they are. The two losers from night one. In the Intercontinental and IWGP title matches from day one. It's okay. I mean, you can call them what they are. The losers of night one. Fighting it out for the right to, I guess, vault back into contention at some point against the champion, whomever it may be. These two had what I thought was a fabulous match in the finals of last year's G1. Which was a match that Ibushi won. This was, I thought, another excellent match. Not as good as that G1 match. It was better than Jay White's match on night one against Naito. And, you know, the stuff with Ghetto, I know it pissed people off, which I guess is the point, because they're heels and they want to piss you off. The shenanigans with the Ghetto were needed, I thought, because you don't want Ibushi to suffer back-to-back clean losses. You know, he lost clean to Okada, hell of a match on night one. For him to go in there now against the heel, Jay White, who always cheats, and just get beat clean, you can't do that. You can't do that to that guy. So you needed Ghetto to be involved. You needed all the bullshit, you know, like it was one of these Jeff Jarrett TNA main events from the mid-2000s. You almost needed that here. You know, but so he lost, but he only lost because Jay White needed help to win. Ibushi avoided a Ghetto distraction early on, hit White with some strikes. White came back, knocked Ibushi off the apron. This is right at the beginning of the match. And when he knocked Ibushi off the apron, Ibushi, he kind of just deadweighted. He didn't, you know, like he just let his body fall off the apron. And he crashed. It looked like throat first, sternum first, that right down into the top of the barricade. That looked like it sucked. Ibushi later on hit a springboard dropkick, power slam, second rope moonsault for a near fall. They went back and forth with some strikes. And then Ibushi went red, as they say. He went red again, just like he did in the match with Okada the night before. I was talking about how scary he looks. He goes into this like trance-like state. It's almost like he's having an out-of-body experience. He looks like this emotionless psycho killer. And he's, you know, kind of smacking Jay White around. White hits a deadlift German, blade buster, Kiwi crusher for a near fall. They go to the top rope. And Jay White is going to go for a superplex. He drops Ibushi chest first right on the top rope, right on that top part of the turnbuckle. And hits a top rope Uranage for a near fall. Ibushi comes back, V-trigger knee, hits the Bomae for a near fall. So Jay White throws Ibushi into the ref, who flew, and I do mean flew, out to the floor. Well, that's Ghetto's cue. He jumps inside with a chair. He used it on Ibushi. Ibushi no-sold it. He sent Ghetto out of the ring with a palm strike. Kamigoye connects, and the Golden Star Powerbomb. Actually, I think that's what he called it when he was in NXT for the Cruiserweight Classic. I don't know if he's ever used that name in Japan. I like that name. I like that name. He hit the Golden Star Powerbomb, but there's no referee. So he hits another Kamigoye. This time the referee is back inside. Ibushi's got the match won. It's all but over, and Ghetto pulls the referee out at the very last second. And Jay White took a chair. I guess there was a chair laying in the ring. He takes that chair. He throws it. He chucks it right at Ibushi's head. Hits him right in the head. And Ghetto clocks Ibushi with a pair of brass knuckles. Straight jacket Bloody Sunday by Jay White. Followed by the Blade Runner. And Jay White secures the victory. And the story now is, how will Kota Ibushi react to this horrible weekend that he has now had at the Tokyo Dome? This was physical. This was brutal in spots. The Ghetto stuff, I think, it did kind of bring it down a bit. You can't... It's hard to judge a match like this with all the interference and the bullshit and the fuck finish against the kind of match they had last summer, which was just purely just the work in the ring. And Ghetto might have been involved in that one too. I actually don't remember, but it didn't factor into the finish. It's like you're judging two totally different matches. To me, it did bring it down a little bit. But again, you can't beat Ibushi clean like that, I don't think, on both nights. So I get why they did what they did here. We had the Painmaker, Chris Jericho, for the first time ever against the ace of New Japan, Hiroshi Tanahashi. If Tanahashi wins, he earns the right to challenge Jericho for the AEW World title, which Jericho wore to the ring. He wore his AEW championship out there to the ring in the Tokyo Dome. There was an epic fail editing out Jericho's theme music. I was all ready to hear him come down to Judas. I think Judas is a very good song. Suits him well. And then they played the message on the screen that says some music has been dubbed over due to rights purposes, and so it just sounded like shit. Yeah, I know they had to. It's not their fault. But it ruined his entrance. It ruined his entrance, and it ruined his exit when the match was over. This is what you would have expected from a Jericho match early on. You know, they brawled over to the English announce desk. Jericho DDT Tanahashi, or as he calls him, Bakahashi, on top of the announce table. It looked more like the edge of the desk. Rolls him back inside. That took out the English commentary for, I'd say, a legit 5 minutes. Just total silence. So Jericho's mocking Tanahashi's air guitar. He goes up top. He's going to use Tanahashi's own move. He goes for his own kind of mutilated version, we'll call it, of a high fly flow. And he crash lands. Camera picks up Tanahashi flashing a devilish smile. He's very happy. He's very proud of what he has just done. So they fight some more. Jericho tries to throw him out. Tanahashi skins the cat. He goes for a flying forearm in the corner. Jericho pulls red shoes in the way, and he gets hit. So we have back-to-back matches with referee bumps. The Americanization of New Japan in full effect here with back-to-back matches with ref bumps. So Jericho kicks Tanahashi low. And then he starts whipping him with his weight belt. Tanahashi returns the favor with a low blow of his own. Jericho tries for the lion salt. Gets shoved out over the top rope. Tanahashi hits a high fly flow onto Jericho on the floor. In a standing position. So Jericho barely makes it back inside in time. Tanahashi hits like four straight dragon screws to Jericho's leg. Supposedly Jericho, his leg was a bit swollen. I'm sure it's fine, but he was feeling that. He was feeling the effects of four straight dragon screws the next morning. So he heads up top for the high fly flow. Jericho gets the knees up on the way down. Walls of Jericho. Tanahashi gets out of it. Hits the sling blade back up. High fly flow. Jericho catches him on the way down with a code breaker. But not really. Tanahashi, he kind of overshot the bullseye, but it looked good enough. Still not enough for a three count, though. Judas effect, back elbow. He tries for it. He misses. Tanahashi hits his own code breaker for a near fall. So we're rocking and rolling here. Jericho counters the sling blade. Tanahashi cradles him for a two. Twist and shout. Sling blade. All of the greatest hits of Hiroshi Tanahashi here. Goes up top. Hits the high cross body. Jericho rolls through into a lion tamer. And he is wrenching down on Tanahashi's back. And finally, Tanahashi is left with no choice but to tap out. So Chris Jericho gets his first Tokyo Dome win, at least since his return to New Japan. Debut? Return? I don't remember. I feel like Jericho wrestled at the Tokyo Dome many, many, many years ago, unless I'm just making that up. I don't remember. But for all intents and purposes, this is his first Tokyo Dome win. It's the biggest Tokyo Dome win of his career, put it that way. Just like he's the youngest AEW champion of all time, which is true. And the longest running, too. He's the longest reigning AEW champion ever. Jericho gets the win, and that means the forbidden door shall remain closed. Tanahashi gets no AEW title match, but this was great exposure for AEW. You know, Jericho gets to carry that championship around, and you know he beat one of the top stars in New Japan clean in the middle, got him to submit. See, Jericho truly is the GOAT. Look at this guy. Everyone's making fun of him. This guy's living the life. He is living the life right now. I thought the match was great. It's exactly what it should have been. Jericho mixes in just enough of what he used to do, like some of the moves and the springboard stuff off the ropes. He mixes that in there with the brawling and the taunting, which works well for him. And, you know, Tanahashi is Tanahashi. What more is there to say? Jericho talked to the media backstage after the match. And he said, "The forbidden door is closed, but I don't think it needs to be closed. Put aside all of the hurt feelings and all of the egos." This is in reference to AEW and New Japan working together. So, you know, he recognizes the same thing that a lot of us recognize. And he said, "Look, I haven't been at the top of this business for 29 years or whatever it's been because I'm a bad businessman." He goes, "We all want to make money. We all want to do business. Let's work together." And I think it will happen. I think it's just in due time. You know, their U.S. expansion, New Japan, has not gone the way they had hoped. There's no way that their expansion has gone the way they had hoped. They lost the Elite crew, which is probably where a lot of these hurt feelings stems from, right? They were banking on at least some of those guys, whether it be Omega, whether it be the Bucks. You know, they were counting on those guys to head up any kind of an expansion here in this country. And then they left. They took their ball and they left. And now they lost their television here in the States, now that Access has booted them off the station, thanks to Anthem. So what does that expansion even look like anymore? I mean, they'll run some tours maybe, although they haven't announced any. So maybe they'll run some dates here in the U.S., but really, what does that expansion even look like anymore? They've done next to nothing with Ring of Honor since the Madison Square Garden show last year, and that was almost a year ago. So I think Jericho's right. I think it's only a matter of time. For now, you know, they may just be content bringing guys in like Moxley and Jericho who have it, you know, written into their deals that they can work if they want to with New Japan. And you know who else has it in his deal? Because he's talked about this, that he can work New Japan if he wants to. Kenny Omega. But so far, he has elected not to do so. And then it was main event time. The finale of the Double Gold Dash, Okada and Naito. Champion versus champion, title for title for the first time ever. Wrestle Kingdom 8. Okada beat Naito. Where their match had been voted by the fans out of the main event spot on the show because Naito wasn't popular enough. They actually voted the Intercontinental title match to headline Wrestle Kingdom that year. Fast forward to Wrestle Kingdom 12. Everybody thought, this is it. This is the night that Naito is crowned. It's his crowning moment. Nope. Wrestle Kingdom 12, Okada beat Naito again. So this was it for Naito. This was his chance at redemption. It's now or never. And Okada dropkicks Naito off the top rope to the floor. He cleared off one of the other announce tables and dropped Naito down knee first onto it. He's working over that knee because, you know, that was what he was selling the night before in the match with Jay White. And he was down for a while. There was a very close call here where he made it back in just in time before the 20 count Naito did. Naito hit a brutal poison rana to Okada, landed right on top of his head. Naito ducked a rainmaker. Okada blocked Destino. Naito flying forearm. Okada escapes Destino. Naito finally hits Destino for a near fall. So Naito ducks a rainmaker. Okada nails him with a dropkick. They're on their knees. They're smiling. Okada's smiling, practically laughing. They're exchanging shots back and forth. They look like a couple of drunk guys who were just messing around somewhere at the local pub. Naito spits on Okada. Okada hits a spinning rainmaker. Naito goes for Gloria. Okada counters it into a tombstone. Okada, rainmaker, near fall. The more that Okada worked over Naito's knees, the more that the fans booed him. They didn't like that. So this was they liked Okada, but this was a pro-Naito crowd. They liked Naito. You could talk about how, oh, it's 2 years too late. Believe me, he still has a lot of support. So Okada hits another rainmaker. He holds on to the wrist to maintain control. Another rainmaker follows. He goes for a third one. Naito ducks it, hits the Destino. Okada kicks out. Now, I know some people hate these kinds of matches. They just spam their finishers, constant kickouts. They think it's just not creative. There are some matches that I'll watch where I absolutely hate it when they do this because they just go one step too far. And I'm like, really? Come on. Like, I have that same reaction to some of the matches I watch. And I've had that reaction to some of the Johnny Gargano, Adam Cole matches. And I love their first match. The one from New York last year, I think it's the greatest NXT championship match that I've ever seen. But by match two and match three, even I was like, all right, you know, like, I get the point. This match, and a lot of these Okada matches, there's just something about the way these matches are structured. no matter how repetitive it is, 6, 7 Rainmakers, it probably is one too many Rainmakers. But I always buy into the emotion here in these matches. The crowd is building and building, and they're behind every near fall, and you just kind of get wrapped up in it all. So really, this didn't bother me. It was clearly building to a climax here. So Naito goes for the Destino. Okada blocks it, and Naito finally hits another Destino. He covers, he gets the pin, and Tetsuya Naito, he fulfills his destiny. He becomes the first ever IWGP Heavyweight and Intercontinental double champion here at Wrestle Kingdom. And then, as he is beginning to celebrate this moment that has literally been years in the making, Kenta comes out and attacks Naito. Hits a PK, hits a go to sleep. Kenta grabs both belts. He sits on Naito's chest cross-legged, just like he did with Shibata when he turned on him. And Bushi ran down and Kenta bailed. Rocky Romero was disgusted on commentary by what he was seeing. He called it bullshit over and over again. Kenta's ruining Naito's big moment here. He said it was bullshit. Now, I know some people are upset. There's a lot of Naito fans who are very upset that they ruined Naito's moment. They should have just let him have his moment. You could do it. You could shoot some kind of an angle the next day at the New Year Dash. But I will say, it got great heat on Kenta. Kenta was already the most despised man in New Japan. I was going to say Jay White, but I think Kenta has him beat. I mean, for what he did to Shibata alone, he would be the most despised. Now, ruining Naito's big moment too? Oof. So I thought it was smart for them to run him out there and do it. But that is now back-to-back match of the year caliber 30-plus minute main events for Okada, who is, among the all-time greats. There could be no valid argument against this. Now, whether he's the very best ever, that you can say is up for debate. But the question of whether or not he is among the very best that there have ever been, there can be no debate. I don't see the debate there. Not when you put together the body of work that this man has put together. And he's only 32. He's 32 years old. If he retired today, he would be an all-time great. Now imagine tacking on another 10 to 15 years on top of that. So I thought night two was excellent. These shows are longer than I would like for them to be. That was combined, it was over 10 hours across the two nights. But, they fly by pretty quickly. I'm never bored by them, outside of some of the lower card stuff with some of the guys I'm not really as familiar with. It's hard to get into, but, it was just a tiring weekend because I didn't watch them live. So I had to play a lot of catch up. I had to avoid spoilers. I'm still trying to put a podcast together in the meantime for this past Sunday on pretty much everything non-New Japan related. But would these main events come across? I guess the question is this. Would these main events come across as epic as they do if they were not 35 to 45 minutes each? Now, sometimes they have to be. Okada's matches, they start out very slow and they build. So going in, it's Okada. You're looking at no less than half an hour. But when Omega beat Okada to win the, I think it was the B block of the G1, it's almost like the forgotten match that the two of them had. Everybody talks about, the 2 out of 3 falls match and the first match, and rightfully so. But that G1 match, that went a little over 20 minutes. And the match was fantastic. So it's proof. It's proof that it can be done. Now, I watched the New Year Dash show from this morning, which featured the retirement ceremony for Jushin Thunder Liger. The cool thing about wearing a mask is that nobody can see you sobbing underneath. So you still look pretty badass. Tanahashi presented Liger with a bouquet of flowers. Okada presented Liger with flowers as well. That is the tradition there. And then Okada, this was great. There were two kind of really memorable moments from this. One was Okada, after this, he's in the ring with all of his fellow Chaos members, and Okada pulls out his iPhone, and he wants to get a selfie. He looked like a fan. He says, "I want to get a selfie with everybody." And everyone makes these cheesy faces. So that was great. And then Liger's wife and son each presented him with flowers. And, even the son was kind of crying a little bit. And they cut to a shot of Tanahashi outside. And he was losing it. He was just bawling. They played this tremendous, I forgot to mention at the beginning of this, they had this tremendous video package of highlights from Liger's career all the way back to 1989 when he first made his debut, all the different outfits and costumes. I don't think they showed Kishin Liger anywhere in here. Yeah, we didn't get to see him, but the video package was tremendous. They played a video message from Antonio Inoki. Liger said he remembers his debut at the Tokyo Dome, and last night he wrestled his final match there after 31 years. He said his mother is not in the best of health, but she was at the Dome last night to watch his last match, and she is here tonight as well for the New Year Dash show. He thanked his wife and son. He said he's made them very lonely, living the life that he's had on the road, but now he's coming home, and they're going to have to put up with him. And then he went to go, he went in to hug Okada, and he gave him a world's strongest slam, and he said, I got a lot left in the tank. I'm sorry. It's a wrong retirement speech. They gave him a 10-bell salute. I mean, he's not dead. They gave him a 10-bell salute. I'm the dumb American here. I'm just used to when I see a 10-bell salute, that means somebody croaked. Thankfully, Liger is very much alive. He got the salute roster, I guess, as a tradition in Japan. They all got in the ring and they tossed Liger up into the air 3 times. It's like Liger was being bar mitzvahed here. Tanahashi then sang along with Liger to Liger's theme song one final time. This was tremendous. This was just the best. And everybody stayed in the ring. Liger left. He did a couple of laps around the ring, slapping hands with the fans. And then, with everybody still in the ring looking at him, he, you know, bid everybody farewell, and he walked down the ramp and walked down the aisle one last time and went to the back. I thought this was tremendous. I was a little worried that somebody was going to come out and they were going to shoot some kind of angle for, you know, heel heat and beat him down, and thankfully that didn't happen. But this is up there with that Ric Flair segment they did on Raw many years ago. Just a very classy send-off for one of the biggest names of all time. They had a Young Lion six-man tag in here. They had also El Desperado and Kanemaru of Suzuki-Gun beating Roppongi 3K, Bushi and Hiromu Takahashi, and Ishimori and El Fantasmo in a four-way. Bushi spit black mist at Desperado, but he ducked. Sho got caught with the mist instead. Desperado rolled him up with the pin, which likely, as is usually the case here in New Japan, sets up Desperado and Kanemaru for a shot at the junior heavyweight tag team titles. When you pin the champion, you get a title shot. That's how it works. That's how it should always work. Kota Ibushi, Hiroshi Tanahashi, Juice Robinson, and David Finlay beat the Gorillas of Destiny, Chase Owens, and Bad Luck Fale. Good match. Sling Blade by Tanahashi to Owens. Ibushi caught him with the Kamigoye for the win. After a losing weekend, Ibushi finally picks up a win. After the match, Tanahashi and Ibushi, they point at Finjuice's IWGP tag team belts and basically threw down the gauntlet. So that sets up a tag team championship match. Only question now is, what do you call these two? If they're going to be a tag team, they have to have a name. I saw that the Golden Aces is a leading contender, which would, you know, that'd be cool. I would throw Tanahashi in there. I kind of like Tanahashi. Simple. Right? I think it should at least be considered. We had Evil and Shingo Takagi beating Tomohiro Ishii and Hiroki Goto. Excellent match. It was the best match on the show. Goto and Shingo traded headbutts. Shingo gave Goto a draping GTR and pinned him with the Last of the Dragon. The announcers pointed out that Shingo had just pinned the Never Openweight Champion. You know what that means. Shingo said that he and Goto are even at one win apiece in singles matches, so why not have a rubber match? And he challenged Goto to a never open weight title match. Okada, Will Ospreay, who did wrestle, despite the injured heel or ankle, it's one or the other, that he sustained at Wrestle Kingdom in his match with Hiromu. There were reports from the building that said that he was favoring the ankle throughout the match. I didn't see it here, but he was in the match. Okada, Ospreay, Yoshihashi, and Robbie Eagles beat Minoru Suzuki, Tai Chi, Lance Archer, and Zack Sabre Jr. by DQ. Tai Chi hit Okada with his iron glove. And this was definitely not as good as the match before it, but the angle that came after was great. So after the match, in the aisle, Zack Sabre, he puts Will Ospreay in a rear naked choke. Tai Chi was about to give Okada a pile driver. All of a sudden, John Moxley's music hits. He comes out through the crowd. Tai Chi runs away. And Minoru Suzuki, he's outside. He perked up when he heard the music. He climbs back into the ring for a little face-to-face with John Moxley. And so they traded slaps, and you could see the sweat flying off Suzuki's face. Moxley drops him with the Death Rider posed over his body with the U.S. title. And he leaves, and Suzuki is all by himself, laid out in the ring, and he's laying there a few minutes later, and he's laughing at himself. He's looking up at the lights, and he is laughing. And then he gets out of the ring, and he's stumbling around, and the whole time, as he's walking down the aisle to go to the back, he's laughing. If Minoru Suzuki was laughing at me, I would enter witness protection. Even if I didn't witness anything, I would ask them to relocate me and give me a new identity anyway. Later on backstage, Suzuki had these comments. He said, "Who do you think you're messing with? That's right. I was waiting for you to come up to me, but I couldn't wait anymore, so I made my move. John Moxley? Nah. Johnny boy, you better be ready when you come at me. I will absolutely kill you." And he will. Oh, he will. I'm ready for this. Something, you know what? I was thinking about this. I think Jericho and Suzuki would be a lot of fun, too, if Jericho ever wanted to do it. Because Jericho has, you know, a lot of potential matchups left in New Japan. I don't think, has he wrestled Okada? I don't think he's wrestled Okada yet. He has, you know, Okada as a competitor to go against, and Kota Ibushi. And Suzuki should be on that short list, I think, of matches for Jericho. Hey, put Jericho in the G1 this year. Be 50 years old. Put Jericho in the G1. Let him get a match in there somewhere against Suzuki. So in the main event, Naito and Sonata beat Kenta and Jay White. Sonata rolled up Jay White for the win. Sonata, as I mentioned earlier, he was the only member of LIJ to leave Wrestle Kingdom without a championship. So I thought there might be the chance of a turn here on Naito. But it never came. Kenta got a lot of heat, as you would imagine, coming off the attack on Naito at Wrestle Kingdom. So whatever they were going for, it seemed to work. Sonata had Skull End on Jay White. Ghetto jumped in. Sonata crotched him on the middle rope. Spinning Skull End by Sonata to Jay White. Sonata goes up for the moonsault. White rolls out of the way. He lands on his feet. And White tried for the Blade Runner, but Sonata reversed into a roll-up with a bridging pin for the win. After the match, Jay White low blows Sonata. Ghetto throws a whole bunch of chairs into the ring. Kenta and Jay White, now they are using the chairs on Sonata and Naito. A double chair attack here. And the heels cut some promos on the baby faces, and Naito and Sonata were helped to the back. I thought this was a pretty good show. You know, it helped set the stage for some new matches coming out of the pay-per-view. Naito has his first challenger in Kenta. Sonata's going to feud with Jay White, it looks like. Tanahashi and Ibushi are going to be challenging for the tag team titles. Tanahashi. Shingo wants a championship match with Goto. I'm sure his request will be granted. Okada and Tai Chi looks to be a thing, which is kind of bizarre, but okay. And Ospreay, if he's healthy, and I would imagine he's probably having some kind of x-ray done on his foot to see how bad the damage is. But if he's healthy, I guess Ospreay and Zack Sabre is a direction, maybe for that British heavyweight title. And of course, the only one that matters, Moxley and Suzuki. So those are the directions coming out of the show. And now I got to get myself into Royal Rumble mode. I got to readjust here now that Wrestle Kingdom has come and gone. You know, people talk about how long of a show WrestleMania is. People like me. And as somebody who has been to each of the last 7 WrestleManias, and that ends this year, by the way, I am tapping out, I can tell you that they have gotten progressively longer over the years. Noticeably longer. 33 in Orlando is what nearly broke me. WrestleMania 33 in Orlando nearly broke me. 7+ hours out there in that stadium. It ended at 12:15 in the morning when The Undertaker was taking his gear off and having this emotional, what we thought was maybe going to be his send-off, and it would have been the perfect send-off for him. It was 12:15 in the morning when he was disrobing. It's like, can you speed this up, please? Anyway, New Japan this year, they split Wrestle Kingdom up into 2 parts for the first time. And I think it's telling that they did not announce that they were doing the same next year. You know, they announced this double shot of the Tokyo Dome a year in advance. And they so far have not announced that they're doing the same thing next year. So they may not be. But they split up Wrestle Kingdom this year, so each show is only 5 hours or so each. I put only in air quotes. It's still very long, but the quality of the shows are always super high. So I think that's why people say, oh, all these hypocrites, you complain about WrestleMania, but what if New Japan? You know what? Honestly, yeah, okay, it's a little hypocritical, but it comes down to the quality of the shows. WrestleMania is hit or miss. You might get a really good WrestleMania, and there have been some really shitty WrestleManias in recent years. Wrestle Kingdom, some are better than others, but every single year, I mean, this show just, it blows you away. You know, the quality is such that people, I think, are willing to let it go, but it is long. It doesn't change the fact that the shows are very long. You know, last year's Royal Rumble show. Okay, we're not even talking WrestleMania. Forget WrestleMania for a second. The Royal Rumble, if you include the two-hour pre-show, was 7 hours long last year. So if it's anywhere close to that this year, keep this in mind. That weekend, that Friday, before the Rumble, there is an NWA pay-per-view. I know not everybody watches the NWA. I do. I would say if you've never watched it, check it out. You might like it. But there's an NWA pay-per-view that Friday. There's the Worlds Collide show the next day with NXT against NXT UK. And then potentially, maybe this year, they'll go for 8 hours. Maybe we'll have an 8-hour Royal Rumble pay-per-view that Sunday. So this will not be the last busy wrestling weekend for the month of January. So get ready. Take care, guys.